Yes, well, it's been nearly 2 weeks since the death of African-American man George Floyd at the hands of police in America. And despite the COVID-19 pandemic and its particularly severe impact in America, the Black Lives Matter protests in the US continue and appear to be growing. Those protests, of course, have spread to Australia with large Black Lives Matter protests across the country calling for change in how Indigenous Australians and Black people generally are treated by police in this country. George Floyd's words, "I can't breathe," of course, have become one of the symbols of the unrest, and those words resonate in Australia too. The family of David Dungay, an Aboriginal man who said, "I can't breathe," 12 times before he died while being restrained by 5 prison guards in Long Bay Jail in 2015, have spoken about how hearing those same words and their slogans, "I can't breathe," from George Floyd's, after George Floyd's death, have sort of, reminded them of the trauma of losing David Dungay. There have been more than 430 Indigenous deaths in custody since the 1991 Royal Commission. And so today on the roundtable, we're discussing the state of relations between Indigenous Australians and police and the very hard work of trying to build better relations. We were hoping to speak with Keenan Mundine as part of the roundtable. Keenan's the co-founder at Deadly Connections Justice, Community and Justice Services, and he's an ambassador for Just Reinvest New South Wales, who grew up in Sydney's Redfern, has had many interactions with the police, but now doing some of that crucial community and justice work. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to get on to Keenan this morning. We'll continue to try to do that. But we welcome to the round table this morning Professor Chris Kanine, criminologist specialising in Indigenous affairs and Indigenous Australians from the Legal Faculty of UTS. Welcome to the roundtable, Chris.
Morning. How are you going?
Very well, very well. Also welcome to the roundtable, Nick Caldas, former Deputy Commissioner of the New South Wales Police Force and a Senior Fellow with ASPI, the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure. And also Sophie Trevitt from Change the Record, which is Australia's only national Aboriginal-led justice coalition of Aboriginal peak bodies and non-Indigenous allies. Sophie Trevitt, welcome to the program. And I'm hoping that Sophie's there, but we'll double check that right now. If I could start with you, Chris Kanine, obviously it was aggressive, excessive policing that caused the death of George Floyd in America. And in New South Wales, we saw an incident of an Aboriginal teenager being aggressively thrown to the ground this week. Could you give us your sort of assessment of the state of aggressive policing in Australia, how it compares to America's problem in that regard?
Yeah, sure. Look, I mean, I think it's a long-standing problem, and unfortunately, I think it still is as much a problem today as it has been in the past. Certainly, the sort of complaints that you get from Aboriginal people, not just in Redfern, but in many other places across Australia, are that those sorts of aggressive tactics are not that unusual, and also many complaints about what Aboriginal people see to be racist or unfair interventions. And so I think despite all the inquiries, despite the Royal Commission of Aboriginal Deaths in Custody nearly 30 years ago, it still remains a problem. Certainly we see pockets of good things happening between police and Aboriginal communities, but I think as a general proposition, I mean, what happened in Waterloo earlier this week or in the last week is still unfortunately, too common, and it has been common for a very long period of time.
Sophie Trevitt, what's your assessment of the state of relations between law enforcement and Indigenous Australians?
Yeah, good morning. Sorry you couldn't hear me.
That's all right, no worries.
I think that for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians, none of the issues that I've seen thousands flock to the street this week are new. They know and we know that we don't need to turn to America to see what racism and heavy-handed policing look like. I've come to the role that changed the record after working as a youth lawyer in Alice Springs, and certainly the type of conduct that Chris mentioned that we saw in Waterloo earlier this week, where a young Aboriginal teenage boy was kicked and manoeuvred to the ground in an extremely heavy-handed way, resulting in injuries. That isn't uncommon. And one of the key things that Change the Record is calling for is for an end to police investigating police and some independent accountability and oversight, so that we can make sure that police are acting in a way that upholds the law and treats all people equally and with dignity.
Nick Caldas, obviously the bulk of your career was as a member of the police. You're the former Deputy Commissioner for the New South Wales Police Force. What do you think of Sophie's recommendation there about not investigating police? And perhaps you can just tell us a little bit about your experience within the New South Wales Police Force of trying to deal with relations with Indigenous Australians and improve them.
Sure. I think I have to broadly agree with the comments of both Chris and Sophie, but a couple of differences I'd bring up. In New South Wales, at least, while police do investigate police on minor matters, there is a huge framework, some would call it an industry, of oversight bodies that delve into everything that the police have done, including those who investigated other police, and they hand down independent findings and so on. There's a Law Enforcement Conduct Commission, there's certainly the Ombudsman, there's magistrates and so on. There's a framework for it. But the reality is, I think, the failure here is, and I'm going to talk about the negatives as well as the positives, if you allow me. There's been two problems, really. I think there's been a fundamental failure to understand the plight of Indigenous Australians, not just in law enforcement, but probably across many levels of government. The second problem is, which has been very, very aptly described by Tanya Day's family, there's been a failure to care. It's not only not doing the right thing, but failing to care that they haven't done the right thing, which has had catastrophic impact on someone. But in terms of what we do in Australia, and I think Chris sort of covered off on this, but there are definitely differences. While there are many similarities, there are many differences between us and the US. In the US, there's over or around 18,000 police forces with really different skill sets and abilities and so on. And in Australia, we only have 8 police forces with I would call it a cohesive sort of national framework that should be able to guide and regulate law enforcement, so it's more easy to enforce and implement change for the better. Having said all of that, while there are positives in terms of programs and progress with engagement with the communities and so on, and Mary Jerram earlier today on the program talked about pockets of people within government and law enforcement who are really committed and passionate about change for the better, it is still incredibly distressing to hear that there's more than 400 people have died in custody since the Royal Commission in 1991. As they say, what's the definition of a madman? Someone who keeps doing the same thing over and over again, expecting the result to be different. Mm. And I'm not sure if we're madmen, but we must be close.
Yeah. Professor Chris Kinneen, you've worked in the area of police training and trying to change the culture of police in America. Could you tell us about your involvement with that, what you learnt from that, and also, maybe get your response to Nick Caldas' comments there?
Yeah, look, I mean, I guess after decades of being sort of around this area, I'm probably, I don't want to use the word cynical, but I'm a bit more reluctant, I think, to see much change eventuating from things like implicit bias training, even questions about accountability. I mean, if we look at Minneapolis, I mean, that was one of the sites in the US, one of 5 sites in the US that had a huge federal initiative put in place to improve relations between police and the African American community. This was obviously before George Floyd died, and that it had been selected because of the problems of poor relations between police and the community. And after an enormous initiative and attempts at change, we see, in fact, that there hasn't really been anything that's sort of shown a positive development. And so, I must admit, after all of this, I come down on the side of people that are calling for defund the police, to think about how we actually cut back on the police and look at community development, community-run programs, Aboriginal-run programs for ensuring community safety. So I think there's always going to be, you know, a great deal of limitations about what we can do around police accountability. Police are very powerful, particularly through police associations, and I think change is very difficult. So I'd like to see a kind of move away from how we think about policing completely to looking at much greater focus on community development. And, of course, some police have been working in that area around justice reinvestment. I mean, that's one kind of example of it. So there is, you know, I think great potential there rather than simply focusing everything on police, but to think about how we can move away from that and think about other ways of maintaining community safety.
Sophie Trevitt, do you agree that it needs to be a profound paradigm shift to try and address this issue? And what does that mean for relations with police?
I do agree. And I think one way to think about it is there are three streams going on at the moment. One is the discriminatory policies, so at a level of legislation and regulation, which see Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people arrested at extraordinary rates. That needs to change. The second is right now, while we have police forces and correctional authorities and prisons and these institutions, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are treated in a discriminatory way. So that goes to Nick's point about the care that people are afforded or not afforded. So that's the second stream. Then the third area is what is the actual structural change that needs to occur to shift the power balances within our community? For so long, we've had non-Indigenous people, non-Indigenous decision makers imposing systems which are fundamentally harming Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. Instead, we need to shift that power back. We know that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, we know that the communities themselves know what problems and issues exist within their communities and have the solutions. So instead of funneling millions of dollars into, say, prisons, which have a terrible track record of rehabilitation, terrible track record of recidivism, why not funnel that money back into communities to keep families together, to help kids find employment and stay in school? There are so many options and so many initiatives. For example, the Deadly Connections Initiative that Keenan was going to talk about on this program, which come from these Aboriginal communities and have leadership and decision-making come from Aboriginal people. That's where we need to be shifting our focus and our attention.
On the round table, we are discussing the state of relations between Indigenous Australians and police forces in the global context of the Black Lives Matters protests. And we're speaking with Professor Chris Kinnean, a criminologist from UTS, Nick Caldas, the former Deputy Commissioner of the New South Wales Police Force, and Sophie Trevitt from Change the Record. We're still trying to contact also Keenan Mundine, who Sophie mentioned there, the co-founder of Deadly Connections Community Justice Services and ambassador for Just Reinvest New South Wales. I think all of our guests so far have referred to, I think the phrase was pockets of good things that seem to only be pockets. But I wondered if we could hear from everyone what you think are those pockets of good things and what they tell us for trying to deal with this issue more broadly. Chris Kinnean, it seems like you haven't seen much success in police training, but what are the pockets of good things you've seen?
Well, I think justice reinvestment is one. It's
and perhaps you can just explain that for us for those who aren't familiar with the concept.
It's connected to this idea of defund the police. In the US, they've been talking about disinvestment in police and reinvestment in community. In Australia, we've got a number of Aboriginal communities working around this idea of justice reinvestment, that you spend less money on corrections and on policing, and you spend that money in improving housing, health, education in communities and providing opportunities for people. And we've seen some positive things in Bourke. The local area police commander in Bourke was very supportive of the Justice Reinvestment Initiative that went on there, and they've seen quite significant reductions in terms of arrests for a number of offences.
And that involves like regular liaison between Indigenous leaders and police. I think I'm
it
right.
It does. And with other government. But the thing about it that's important, and it ties back to what Sophie said, it's actually led by the Aboriginal community. And I think that's the key to this. And I'll just one other example, which is a long-running one, has been the development of Aboriginal night patrols, which is, you know, a community initiative designed to provide safety for the community. And we've seen those running right across Australia. And, interestingly, they were set up by Aboriginal women in the late 1980s to respond to things like alcohol abuse and domestic violence. And that's, you know, the community responding themselves to issues. And I think they're the sorts of things that we should be looking at.
Nick Caldas, obviously addressing the social causes that bring people into sort of interaction with police is clearly important. We're hearing that strongly from Chris and Sophie. One of the shocking things about speaking to Belinda Day about what happened to her mother was the fact that there were procedures in place for intoxicated people when they were under police custody, and those procedures just weren't followed, and it allowed an accident to happen, which ultimately led to a really preventable death. From the inside, what's your experience about how to try and change practices, and what works to prevent the most serious harms that have been occurring from, you know, happening more prominently?
Sure. Yeah, I think there's probably two or three points. One is, I think, as they say, the tone starts at the top. So it's a question of leadership. If the leaders in a police force are talking about these sorts of issues and making it clear what their expectations are on a daily basis, internally and externally, to the public and the media and so on, it does have a huge impact. The second issue is in relation to accountability. Certainly in New South Wales, and I don't know, I guess in most of the other police forces in Australia, there's a thing that started in New York that's called CompStat that Chris, I'm sure, would be familiar with, which is really measuring every aspect of the performance of a police force to see whether they're up to scratch or not. In New South Wales, they've taken it to a great, you know, level of accountability in terms of measuring the number of complaints, for instance, that a local area command gets, how they're dealt with, how quickly they're dealt with, whether the customer or client is satisfied with the outcome, and so on and so forth. But the key to accountability in policing is to measure and then to have transparent, defendable criteria for whether you tell someone they've failed or haven't failed. That tends to focus commanders, certainly, if they're going to be judged on the performance of all of their people. And on the defunding issue, if I can just add, that could be a third leg that Chris has mentioned. As I understand it, in the US, the defunding is more about stopping the funds for giving police high-level tactical weapons and equipment. A lot of it is surplus military gear that they've given it to them. It started under President Clinton, and it really went on from there and perhaps went too far. I do strongly support Chris's point there that the focus on police only in terms of funding and so on is really not sustainable. There are so many other areas of government activity that should be and could be funded, but the focus tends to be on the you know, after the person has sort of fallen off the cliff, not literally, but the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, which is the police. After something's happened, the police are one of the few 24/7 agencies around, and everything gets lumped on them. A lot of these issues are societal, and the answer is not policing. It's about getting other government agencies funded and equipped, chartered and empowered to do things that stop the police ever becoming involved, hopefully.
Chris Kinneen, as we heard, there have been over 430 deaths, Indigenous deaths in custody since 1991, and Nick Caldas rightly points out that the data matters. Has the pattern of where Indigenous deaths happen to occur in custody, has that changed over the years, and does that suggest areas that need to be focused on?
Well, yeah, I mean, it definitely has changed. At the time the Royal Commission reported, the majority of deaths were in police custody, whereas today about 80% of deaths in custody actually occur in prison. So we've seen, and I think there's a number of reasons for that change, from the majority being in police custody to the majority being in prison. I mean, one is because prison numbers themselves have grown really exponentially over that 30-year period. Also, there are people spend less time in police cells than they might have during the 1980s when the Royal Commission was investigating the deaths. So I think that there is that change that's occurred. And there's also been some good schemes that have been introduced, like the custody notification scheme, which requires police, in New South Wales, it legislatively requires police to notify the Aboriginal Legal Service of an Aboriginal person's in custody. That's being introduced in other places. Yeah. I think that's had some positive influences as well. So,
good to hear. And we're running out of time. So just finally, Sophie Trevitt, if there was one thing that you could particularly change about the relations between police and Indigenous people in Australia, what would it be?
Well, I actually think this comes down to the point that Chris just made, which is people are overwhelmingly dying in prisons because they're being funneled into prisons at far greater rates than the rest of the population. We had stats released just on Friday that showed that even in this last quarter, we've seen an increase in the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people being put in prison, sometimes before they've even been convicted of a crime. So they're being held on remand. So fundamentally, what we need to do is get rid of the discriminatory laws, which lead to the mass imprisonment of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and start looking at some of the reasons why police target and end up arresting Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people more than others.
Okay.
So that's fundamental, I think, is keep Aboriginal people out of prison.
Absolutely. And look, we're not going to be able to come back to Nick Caldas, but thanks. Thank you, Nick, for being part of the roundtable today, former Deputy Commissioner of the New South Wales Police Force. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you. And thanks very much.
Great. And thank you to Sophie Trevitt from Change the Record and Professor Chris Kinnean from the Law Faculty of UTS. Thank you both for being part of the roundtable today.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.